This is the Fucking Normal Podcast, the cheers, tears and Friday night beers of parenting disabled children.
I'm Rena.
And I'm Lauren.
And we're both mothers to daughters with special needs. Parenting a disabled child can often feel difficult to navigate. If this is you, you're not alone. We're here to share unique parenting stories and chat about the things that we've learnt and are still learning.
Prepare to sometimes laugh, sometimes cry, but hopefully leave with a shot of optimism in your arm. And don't forget, we are talking from a parent's perspective. We would never presume to talk on behalf of a disabled child or adult. So expect bad language and, quite frankly, some brutal honesty.
Because really, what the fuck is normal anyway?
Wake me up, loud as clouds, all my love for you.
Welcome to the Fucking Normal Podcast. We're your hosts, I'm Rena.
And I'm Lauren.
And today, we'll be talking about owning your own narrative. So far, we have talked mostly with parents of disabled children, families that, like Lauren and I, are not in the cliche carefree pampers advert of parenting path. Like all mothers, we are learning about our kids as we go and as they grow, learning who they are, what their needs are and wants, medical or emotional. We're making decisions and advocating for them, and also crucially trying to help them to understand their own identity. What is their story? We hope that they'll be able to take ownership of their story and that we are giving them the tools to feel proud of who they are and to take up their place in the world. So today we'll be talking to Emmett de Monterey on his story.
So who is Emmett? Emmett grew up in southeast London during the 1980s. He was diagnosed as having cerebral palsy at 18 months old, and at times has felt the full weight of society's prejudice, both ableist and homophobic. Undergoing cutting-edge surgery in America aged 12, Emmett was a charity poster child for a groundbreaking gait surgery for cerebral palsy, something that would lead Emmett to confused emotions and sometimes scorn from the disabled community. Now Emmett has written his life story in a truly wonderful book. It is both heartwarming and heartbreaking as he describes his hopes and dreams, at times his shame and disappointment, and ultimately his fight to be seen and accepted for who he is. We're also welcoming back Gemma Sherlock to join the discussion today, who we interviewed in episode 2 of the podcast. As a reminder, Gemma is mother to 2 boys. Her eldest, Jasper, now 8, has cerebral palsy. She's recently got to know Emmett and will lead off our discussion with him today. So welcome, Emmett and Gemma. So great to have you both here.
Such a pleasure, thank you.
Yeah.
I was going to just say how beautiful your book is, and I haven't got all the way through, but what I have read so far has been really moving for me, actually, Emmett, because it's something that I've thought about doing myself, potentially writing the story of mothering a child with a disability. And yet something's always stopped me from doing that. And I think really it is that line between where is it my story and where does it become his story? And I was fascinated to know how you had approached that. You write so sensitively about your parents' experience in a way that's so graphic, as though you were there. Did you sit down with them and talk about that time?
Well,
or how did you approach writing?
I should just say that I was selected to be part of a scheme run by Penguin Random House called Right Now, which discovers and nurtures new talent from communities that are currently underrepresented in publishing. So I sort of won a competition to write my story. I was one of 10 writers to be asked to write my story. And so when I told them what was happening and that I had decided to write my story, I realised that actually I couldn't tell it without their input, because it's not just my story. And as you say, it's the story of a family and the story of the way all of our lives changed with my diagnosis, not just mine, but their hopes and dreams for me and their, the visions of life for themselves that they had, you know, radically changed when they got my diagnosis. So the way that I approached it was to kind of interview, not in a formal way, I didn't sit down with a dictaphone and kind of, because I was very aware that for the first 2 or 3 years that I write about, I was there, but it wasn't really happening to me. It was much more at that point happening to them. So I really wanted to know how they had felt, you know, what their anxieties were, what it was like to suddenly have this diagnosis and have to learn a new language, if you like.
But it's interesting that you feel that those first early years, like the diagnosis years, weren't happening to you, but because they were happening to you, but because it's pre-memory, I suppose, and they are your advocates and your carers. As parents, we do kind of take ownership of that part of a child's story. Mm. And at the moment, that still does feel very much like my story to
tell. Does that feel where you are at the moment?
I think we're on the cusp of that. And as Jasper turns 8 and is becoming, you know, a separate being in so many ways, and in so many ways not, which I'm sure we'll get onto, that then makes me question how much of it is my story and how much of it I've created and imposed upon him, and how you allow that to flourish. And I think being able to write it down, go back in time, experience what they're experiencing, and then find your own voice from that must have been, was it therapeutic process? Or
I mean,
that's a really interesting question. I think the most honest answer is that I hoped it would have been much more cathartic than it turned out to be. And one of the reasons why I wrote it was for the boy that I had been, because obviously I'm in midlife now, so it felt like a kind of safe vantage point to write it from, because a lot of the challenges that I write about in the book, I've now safely traversed. I've got a relationship, I've got a future, I'm much more settled than I was. But I'm afraid it didn't feel cathartic, actually. It felt, you know, when I submitted it finally to my editor, I had expected to feel resolved around it.
Yeah.
And I just don't, quite honestly. I'm really pleased to have written it, and I really hope that it resonates with people and that it finds an audience. But it was a much more emotionally complicated process than I had imagined. Although, having said that, you know, I'm very glad to have done it.
Yeah.
I'm very glad to have been given the opportunity. I think, as a disabled person, because ableism is so insidious, you know, internalised ableism is still a factor as well. It's not a process that can ever be fully resolved, because you're always in relation to the society in which you function. It's never something that stops, in a way that, as a gay person, you're always coming out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's never a process that ends. Whatever social situation you're in, there's an opportunity to either come out or not. There's a decision that you have to make.
Yeah.
So it's kind of similar to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
In the process of writing it and talking back to your family, were there any kind of revelations for you? Because, like say, there are things that you were learning about that you didn't have memory of, or perhaps hadn't talked about before with your parents, like your birth story or the specifics of your diagnosis. Were there any revelations for you?
There were lots of things I didn't know, and there were lots of things I hadn't wanted to know.
Mm.
And what really struck me and really made me feel sad for my mother in particular was just how alone she felt with it, because I hadn't really understood what a trauma it had been, and I mean a physical trauma, what a physical trauma it had been for her. And I have to state that, you know, this is in the late 70s, which is a very, very different time to the time that we're living in now. And, you know, her body was kind of, for want of a better word, taken control of. During my birth process, she told me she wanted to get up and walk around, and she literally couldn't. She was forced onto her back. So anyway, I don't want to go into that too much, but what I understood in a way that I hadn't before was just what a trauma it had been for her, and how much sadness and regret she has around that. You know, we have a great relationship. She's a wonderful person.
She's
terrific. Both my mum and my dad are. But yeah, I suppose I felt really sad for her. And as a younger disabled person, I was very focused on my own grieving process, my own coming to terms with what my diagnosis was and what my physical limitations were, and how the world saw me as a result of that. And I hadn't, to be frank, I hadn't thought about my parents.
And neither should you. No. It's a fascinating process to go through when you write the memoir and to go back and to open your mind to your parents' experience. I mean, not many of us would ever really do that. Maybe having children does force you to kind of have a new understanding of your parents, but particularly under those kind of extreme circumstances and all the surgery you then went through, the experience for her, and also probably caring for your mental well-being. I think it's incredibly compassionate of you to be able to put yourself into her foot, because really it shouldn't be for you to, she wouldn't want you to have to do that, but you've chosen to do that. And it comes across really, really sensitively in the book. It's just...
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
I guess, it's, like Rena said at the outset, we've largely talked to parents in similar boat to us. And as Gemma said, your mum comes across as just the most amazing woman in this book. Clearly not everything that parents do helps, always in hindsight the right thing to do. Parents make mistakes. But it sounds like you had a very empowering and safe home to grow up in, like that, all that love and acceptance was huge. It's a big question. What did they get right, your parents, that, you know, we can learn from as parents to disabled children?
Please share.
I don't want to, well, why not boost them unreservedly? I would say they got most things right, to be perfectly honest. They were staunch advocates for me, and they fought for me every step of the way, from investigating medical options, fighting for my schooling. I was one of the first people to undergo the process of getting a statement of special educational need. I was one of the children in the pilot scheme around integration into mainstream schools, so they pushed for that. And every step of the way, my parents wouldn't just take the received medical wisdom. They would always ask why. And what's the benefit? If you're proposing an intervention, be it surgical or social, for our child, why? And actually, they fought for me to get into mainstream education, because I write about in the book that I was in a disabled nursery to begin with. And my mother and father were very against the idea of segregated education for the disabled, because disability in this country currently stands at 22%, you know, of both visible and invisible disabilities, and they didn't want me to be hidden away in any way, because, you know, I think we need to rethink our relationship as a culture to disability, because it's a material fact. So why should we be hidden away as though we don't exist? So, and when my parents were saying to the people at my nursery that they had this idea that they wanted to put me into mainstream education, the principal said, oh, the world can be very cruel, children can be very cruel, and there's always going to be a space for Emmett should he need to come back. And actually, I flourished in that. So I'm kind of, it's a long answer, but they really did everything right. And the internalized ableism that I began to feel and experience later on, they were very distressed by. They fought for me to accept myself much more than I could initially, because as I grew, I began to see that people didn't look like me, people didn't walk like me. There were things that I couldn't do.
Do you remember that time of consciousness, of feeling different?
Very much.
Do you remember what sort of age it was? I'm fascinated to know, because I think Jasper's always had an awareness that he has some differences, but we talk openly, as I'm sure you guys do as well, about difference, that everybody's different, everybody has something. But I think he has an underlying understanding that of disability, but he still doesn't quite know what that means. So I'd love to know what your conscious memory of your own disability.
It's a really ordinary, kind of quite prosaic moment. I was walking down the street with my mum, and I was initially carried, and then I started to walk on a rollator, a children's size rollator, and then I sort of graduated from a rollator onto my first pair of baby sticks, and I was learning to walk on those and finding it quite difficult. And I walked down the road with my mum one day, I think just to the sweet shop, and it was a very sunny day, so there were shadows on the pavement. And I remember watching her. She was a few steps ahead of me, and she was just sort of swinging her arms, and just kind of, she had this relaxed, lazy rhythm, you know, and I looked at myself and I could see my shadow. I must have only been about 5 or 6. I mean, it was really that young. Mm. And I could see myself on the pavement. And it was the first time I saw the kind of image printed on the pavement. And I thought, it really frightened me. Here was this person I loved most in the world. And I became very aware of the distance between us. Mm. And I think I'd say, I could run to her, but I could never catch up. So I became very aware of that gap. And as a very young child, any gap between you and the people that you love and the people that take care of you is very alarming.
Isn't it fascinating that it was like a physical reflection of yourself back at you, that you could then see yourself, not in a mirror, but like almost a drawing of yourself, a shadow.
Exactly.
That to see ourselves, sometimes we need to take ourselves out of ourselves. And that was the moment that you suddenly saw the difference. I was watching last night Crip Camp again. I know we've talked about this. And for anyone who hasn't
watched it, please
go and watch it, because it is, even as a parent of a child with a disability, and I know you've enjoyed it yourself, it's just so eye-opening. And there's a scene, it's about a camp just outside of New York in the 70s, where kids with a range of all different needs and disability could go to camp like all of their friends and be free for the first time from their parents and their carers and just hang out with each other and have a summer. And that a lot of those children then went on to do incredible things in the future in terms of disability rights. And there's a scene in that film when the kids are sitting together talking about their parents, and they talk freely about how much they love their parents, but how reliant they are upon their parents. And the overriding theme of that conversation is the need for privacy, the need for freedom, the need for liberty. And it really hit me like a ton of bricks, because Jasper's so young, it's so easy to care for a small child, but as they grow and they need more freedom, how do I as a parent separate myself in that way, especially when they have seizures, or, you know, I have a camera on him all through the night. Mm. He's going to grow into a teenage boy, he's going to want freedom. Do you remember feeling angry or frustrated at your parents, and that like conflicting feeling of like needing their care but also wanting to be liberated?
I remember one of the physiotherapeutic interventions that I went through pre-surgery. So it was 8 or 9. I had to have my hamstrings were getting really tight. I've got cerebral palsy too, like Jasper, but the subsection of that is spastic diplegia. So it means that my muscles all over my body are very tight and very, they needed to be stretched. I was being pulled into a crouching gait, and one of the things that was produced was with these splints, these night splints. So I was basically strapped into these rigid plastic tubes with knee straps and ankle straps, and had to sleep in them. And oh my God, I hated them so much, because I like to sleep curled up and I like to pull my legs up to myself. And it was the first time I began to have real disagreements with my parents, because they wanted to follow the advice that they were being given, and they felt that they were being advised correctly. And I just hated them so much. Mm. And it meant that I couldn't sleep properly. And I would always call them in the middle of the night to be released from them, because they were just so uncomfortable. And in the end, we just stopped using them as a family, and we didn't tell the...
That's so interesting, because Jasper is about to start serial casting on his leg. So it's similar.
Yeah, very similar.
Wear a cast for a week, but they stretch the muscles and ligaments, and then they'll switch it. And they'll do that for 4 weeks. He knows it's happening, and he's really angry about it. But he's grown into a very compliant, complicit child, because he's had so much surgery and so much intervention. He never says no. He's just coerced into everything. And I'm the one that coerced him. So I'm the split between, like, I'm doing it for his care, but then I just feel sometimes kind of monstrous. And he knows the casting's coming, and I feel really conflicted about it, because I know it's probably for the best. But to hear that, you know, the anger that you felt is, it's an emotional thing. At what point? So your parents said no more?
They this is kind of, on quite a selfish level, they didn't want their sleep interrupted. They got to a point where they were exhausted, and it's an interesting point that you're raising, Gemma, about questioning what is beneficial and what is ableist, and what is that line between what is ableism, what is pandering to the medical model. It's difficult because you want to allow your child to celebrate their body, to be at home in their disabled body, and to embrace their disability in a positive way. But at the same time, I hear what you're saying, and certainly it's what my parents went through, of you want to do what you feel is best for your child. And I really feel for you, because at the moment it doesn't sound as though you can have the conversations in the way that you feel you need to.
No.
So, yeah, it's I don't have an easy answer, and I can't speak for Jasper's experience.
It's just a lovely opportunity to talk to somebody who lives a life as a person with cerebral palsy, as opposed to just parenting somebody with cerebral palsy. And with the benefit of hindsight, we're all different, everybody's needs are different. I mean, you can't answer anything specifically about Jasper, but just the flip side of it is
incredibly insightful.
That's lovely of you to say, but one of the reasons I was so keen to do this podcast today was that it's about the whole experience, that, you know, it's about the way it affects the children, the families, the interactions that we all have with wider society and what they look like, how to protect one another from quite often a very hostile society. So it's a pleasure to have this kind of conversation.
Did a moment in time come when you were able to take ownership over your own medical needs and decisions? Like, do you remember that being okay? Like, because obviously up until now I've signed all the the surgery forms and made all the decisions.
First time that happened was when I was about 10 or 11. I was under the care of Guy's Hospital at the time, and we had some very good consultants and a lovely woman who I write about in the book, and she said, by the time your child reaches his adult body mass, he will be pulled off of his feet into a wheelchair. And they suggested some quite haphazard medical interventions, which were the only things that were then available. Processes of hamstring cutting, and also pills like baclofen, which is derived from a botulism toxin, Botox injections, as it's now become. And my parents were kind of like, you haven't been able to give us a satisfactory answer as to what this will achieve. And they were quite bolshy and brave, and they said, we're not going to allow you to cut up our child on a whim. It's not good enough, you know, because, you know, you'd get two children and they'd have the same diagnosis and they'd have the same surgical procedures, radically different outcomes. Then I was put forward as a candidate for this surgery, which at the time was really groundbreaking. And I remember going to Guy's and being photographed and being filmed, my gait being filmed. On the way home, my mum said to me, and again, this is a scene in the book, she said, if you don't want to go, you know, this is a family decision, but ultimately it's your decision. Mm. And if you don't want to go and you want to have life in a wheelchair, then it's far from the worst thing that could happen. Mm. And it can be navigated and it can be embraced. Because I think she felt that one of the risks of the surgery is that I wouldn't embrace my disability. Mm. I wouldn't embrace my body as it was. And actually, while I don't regret the surgery at all, and I'm quite glad to have had it still, and we'll get onto the surgery in more detail in a minute, I think it did increase my internalised ableism enormously. And I think it took me a very, very long time to be able to inhabit my disabled identity with any degree of pride. And now that I'm in midlife and have an easier relationship with it, I have a great deal of sadness around it, a great deal of grief around it, because actually my body was never the problem. You know, and the social model of disability quite rightly argues that it's the prejudices of the people around you and the wider society around you that are much... I can't speak for anybody else or or any other impediment than mine. But in my case, certainly, the built environment is as disabling as my impairment. And people's prejudices and the barriers to my accepting myself are so pronounced still.
Can we turn to the surgery then and just explore that? In the book, you talk about the fact that you were in a documentary, you were filmed the whole time, there was a lot of tabloid stories about you, and as tabloid stories often are, they were with overinflated potential outcomes from the surgery that you were undergoing. So that must have been, and you talk about believing or hoping that there would be some sort of miracle through this surgery, as opposed to what the doctors and the medical people involved were telling you.
It's really difficult to, I mean, I thought about this a lot as I was writing it, because I have quite a difficult relationship to it still, because on the one hand, I'm very grateful and glad that I went through the surgery in some respects, because I'm still able to walk at 46. But on another level, going through that kind of experience in the public eye was really peculiar. But I should say as well that we're a very small family. We're only three. And some of the journalists, well, most of the journalists that came with us and the news crews that came with us and the huge media hoopla was actually really, in some ways, really good, because you were too distracted to be able to think about what was going to happen. And the people became friends.
They gave you presents, yeah, didn't they, in the hospital?
And they became real friends, and they gave me a lot of care and consideration. And it was quite useful in some ways. But what was so difficult was, and again, I don't really blame them for this, but the media rhetoric around the surgery was quite simplistic. And I remember a particular headline from the South London Press at the time was "Boy's Sci-Fi Bid to Walk."
Wow.
Which again makes walking the gold standard. Which now as an adult I'm slightly uneasy about.
But you were so young as well. I mean, like, to read that about yourself in a newspaper, aged 12, were you?
Yeah. And I remember the surgeon came to me not immediately post surgery, because I was unconscious for nearly a week. But when I came round, he said to me, I'm quite uneasy about the notion. He found the media kind of noise around the whole story really baffling. Mm. And he was a scientific man. He wasn't a media person at all. And he just said, I just wanted to clarify something. I wanted to say, we're talking in terms of improvement. We're not talking in terms of any miraculous outcome. Mm. So, you know, you will be able to walk well into adulthood, and it will be much more energy efficient. But it's not a miracle. It's not a miracle, and you will not be able to walk unaided. So he was very uneasy around the media narrative. But I also don't blame the journalists, because that was the story that they were tasked with telling.
You were the poster child for this. Did you feel like you and your family had to kind of play a role, you know, like super grateful or super happy, or because it was being played out in the media so much and it had turned into this thing?
Well, I remember my parents were interviewed quite a lot for the QED documentaries, because there were two in the end, because the first one was so well received. And they were interviewed on their own, and they were quite candid about what a bolshy teenager I was becoming.
Yes.
About how awkward I was becoming, and about how I was stepping into myself. I wasn't too grateful, and I wasn't too, like... And there were times when I certainly wasn't polite, and I certainly wasn't... Because it was awkward to be... Mm-hmm. Even though it was well-meaning, it was awkward to be the focus of that much attention. And I remember the charity office. The charity was called Once More Step, and we helped them raise money to bring the Gait Laboratory technology to Guy's Hospital. And I used to get a lot of mail, particularly after the documentaries aired, and it used to come to the charity offices, and they used to go through it and then forward it to me. And occasionally, very peculiar stuff would come through, like caricatures that people had drawn of me with Bible verses underneath.
Oh, dear Lord.
So there was this linking of the idea of disability with sin, the idea that somehow my disability was a test or somehow my fault, something that I had morally fallen short of. I mean, so that was just bananas and really, really upsetting for us to receive as a family. And in the end, we asked for them not to forward any more of the mail because it was really quite intrusive and peculiar, and it gave me my first taste of the way disability is problematized in our culture. And like the campaign that's going on at the moment with that charity Changing Faces, where they're trying to kind of interrogate the narrative, you know, that lazy Hollywood shorthand of, if you're a villain, you've very often got a facial deformity or a visible difference.
Or a disability.
Exactly. So why has that become a shorthand in our culture? So that disability is somehow seen as a failure and a moral failure. I mean, I find that really problematic.
Did you have any feeling at the time that you were actually losing, you could potentially be losing something intrinsic of who you are? Mm-hmm. The idea that you're suddenly going to have this miracle and you could walk, even though that really wasn't what it was. Did you inside have a feeling that actually I quite like this? I don't want to do that.
I'm afraid not. That's something that's come to me in much later life. And I'm sort of ashamed to acknowledge how long it took me to inhabit my disabled body with anything like pride. The messages I received as a child, I internalised enormously. And I really believed that the messages that I was receiving about, that I was the problem and that I needed to be fixed. Mm-hmm. And so when that fixing process didn't look like I imagined it would, I went into a very profound grief. I write a scene in the book of where I get to guys to have my cast taken off, and they take the bandages off and they take the stitches out, and my grandmother's there looking after me, and I have my first bath for like months. I've been having sponge baths and washing my hair in the garden, and they leave me alone for a while to just look at my new body and look at my legs. And my grief around it was so profound because I remember looking at them and thinking, they've changed, but they haven't changed nearly as much as I had hoped and would have liked them to. And I say at the end of the chapter, you know, I would always be walking, but I would always be balancing on my hands.
Mm.
So, you know, it was a change, but it wasn't nearly as much as I wanted. And now that I can inhabit as a person in midlife, who is very healthy actually, and is walking and having a rich, full life, I have a great deal more compassion and respect for my body. Mm. And one of the things my mother particularly was quite anxious about around me having the surgery was that I wouldn't be able to embrace myself, that it would potentially alienate me from my disabled community. Mm. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. You know, I was in mainstream education, I didn't have any disabled friends, I didn't have a disabled community or a disabled culture, and so I was always in a position where I was feeling like I had to play catch-up and
change in order to fit
in. Exactly.
Or somehow
that.
Not as much as. I had a sort of flip experience in that when I was 18, I was in a car accident and I broke my spine from the top of my neck down to the ground.
Oh, goodness.
I was in hospital for a long time. I was told early on, you won't walk again. And it was that realisation as a young teenager that I'm going to live my life as somebody who doesn't walk and in a wheelchair, trying to grapple with that in my head, this feeling that I'm going to be somehow, I won't be able to have these friends anymore, I won't have the same life anymore. And as it turned out, I had surgery and I can walk, they just fixed it with a plate. But I definitely went to that space of just thinking like my whole life is going to change and feeling like it would be a profound loss, which I have guilt about too, because I look back and think loss of certain things, but also just moving into a new, as an older person, we embody our bodies and we can feel the edges of life suddenly, and we're so grateful for what we have, our health and our, and we can feel, you know, the time so much. But as a teenager, as a young person, as you were, it's just a sense of loss, I should imagine.
Yeah, it really
might be as much as
it really was. And I love your expression that we can feel the edges of life. I love that. You know, you're conscious of how much time is behind you and how much time is left. And one of my reasons for writing the book was I wrote the book for the person that I was. It was the kind of book, you know, representation matters and positive representation matters. And, you know, I couldn't read anything like that. It didn't exist. I didn't have a narrative like this. The only book I'd read about disability was My Left Foot by Christy Brown.
Oh, yeah.
And obviously it's a very different context to mine, very different time period to mine. And he also didn't have to grapple with the understanding that he was gay. So there's a lovely quote from the writer Toni Morrison where she goes, if you can't find the book that you want to read, then you must write it. So I thought, I mean, it's quite challenging because I'll never be as good a writer as she was. But
it's beautiful, Emma. Yeah. I think it's a stunning book.
Thank you. But I wrote it for him, and it was really the story that I needed. But going back to what you were saying about, you know, our shifting relationships with our physical selves, I still sometimes have a difficult relationship with my body, and I would be disingenuous to say that it isn't an ongoing process because I don't exist in isolation. None of us do.
Mm.
And the ableism that I experience is just enormous.
Mm.
And it is disabling, much more than my body is. Mm. You know, the things that society demonstrates about me every time I go out of my front door, unfortunately, is still a real factor in how I navigate my own identity. And it's something I'm really interested to hear about from the three of you, about how, as parents of younger children, what your fears are around that as they grow.
I thought it was really interesting to me in your book that a lot of the ableism and prejudice that you were experiencing from outside of the home, really as you go through the book, actually, and you move to this educational setting that's a more specialist education, actually the prejudice and the amount of prejudice you get there is homophobic.
Mm.
And it's like the narrative changes halfway through the book as you're in that setting and actually suddenly almost not disabled enough to fit into that world, if I can put it like
exactly.
But too queer to pretend otherwise, although you do talk about how you pretended to have a girlfriend and tried to mask that. Yeah, it really struck me when I was reading it that actually a lot of the time when I think about B as my disabled child, I do think about her identity and who she is, you know, as a person broadly, but it always has that disability angle to it.
Hmm.
And
it's always the lens, isn't
it? It's the lens, yeah.
Which you're looking at something.
Exactly, but actually her identity as she grows up, and we've talked about Andrew Solomon, Far From the Tree, on the podcast before, and I know you've read
it. Amazing book.
But it's like this assumed version of her identity, this assumed way that I think that she's going to see the world or feel the world or look at herself. It really challenged my assumptions about who she's going to be. Are we going to be always going on about fighting for inclusion and fighting against ableism? Or is there going to be other strings to their identity? Of course there is. Of course there's going to be other strings to their identity that, and I God hope that they aren't things that they're going to be bullied for or encounter prejudice for.
Those other facets that will happen to our children as they grow up that have nothing to do with their disability.
Correct, yeah.
Are the things that will become their own narrative and their own story.
Yeah,
absolutely.
As with us, finding your own sexuality or discovering that your daughter has an eating disorder when she's 14 and she's making herself really sick. Those things will happen to our children as disabled people as much as they happen to anyone else. And I don't know, for you, did you always know that you were gay? Or
no, and unfortunately, I mean,
it would not something we always talk about, sexuality.
It would be narratively much more easy if I had a defining moment where I could have gone, yeah, that was it. It was a much more gradual process for me. And I remember I went to a very kind, small state primary school near to where I lived. And as I was about to transition into my 11 plus school, I remember sitting on the bench one day and just seeing the boys play football and just wanting to be part of that so much. And so my initial kind of sexual realisation was tied up, I thought, again, my ableist internal narrative, was tied up with what I thought was wanting to be normal. I idealised certain boys that I knew, and I thought that that was simply because I wanted to be them. I wanted to climb trees, I wanted to kick balls, I envied the way that they inhabited their bodies with such ease and
confidence.
Exactly. And actually, it took me a long time to recognise that there was a sexual component to that. And it wasn't just wanting to be them, it was something slightly more complicated. And as you touched on, Gemma, when I was about 14 or 15 and back in the disabled school and beginning to understand that this wasn't a passing phase and this was going to be part of my identity, it was so complicated because as a disabled person, I was surrounded by other disabled people, but we weren't seen in any way. We weren't encouraged to see ourselves in a sexual way. Mm-hmm. And the counsellor that I saw as part of my adjustment to the new educational setting, and also I write about it in the book, I developed quite a profound eating disorder for a short period of time, and my parents were splitting up, so it was psychologically complicated time. And she was a lovely person and part of the reason why I decided to train subsequently. But she had found a manual in America of basically a sexual manual for people in wheelchairs and with other disabilities too, about how they could engage with each other in intimate ways. And this was discovered, and she was really castigated for it, because the assumption was that any kind of sexuality wasn't part of our stories, wasn't part of our identities at all, which was really difficult.
It's dehumanising.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Because
othering completely.
Absolutely, that's exactly the right word. But I have to say, it mirrored my own fears, because I would occasionally buy kind of gay magazines on the way home, and only if the newsagent wasn't too crowded. And
yeah, like, you state that a few times in the book. Wasn't too busy.
Yeah, I was quite ambivalent and quite like, can I even reach? But I used to get home and sort of read them, and I was terrified, quite frankly, because the images of gay life that I saw were very much around nightlife and hedonism and physical perfection.
I'm guessing there weren't many disabled people in those magazines.
No, none. I mean, it's quite different.
Or fetishized,
quite different now, and luckily we're having a different moment around body positivity. And although I have to say, I don't want to be falsely optimistic, I think there's still enormously long way to go. And I think, I don't think it's still an easy path to tread. And I think, most people would still not deal with it, which was another reason for writing the book. But I remember, again, my lovely parents, I remember coming out to my mum finally, which was a surprise to absolutely nobody, because I'd been drawing endless pictures of Elizabeth I, and I don't know why it was her, but I was she was a queen.
I love that your mum got you that dressing gown as well that you describe in the book, the silk dressing gown.
No, she didn't get it from me. I stole it.
You stole it from her. Sorry.
No, I didn't have a dressing gown. I didn't want a white toweling board. I didn't want that.
No, of course not.
I was feeling much more flamboyant, and this was really weird. I was hiding in plain sight. It was almost like I wanted somebody to guess. I wanted somebody to ask me, because at my first night in this boarding school, I've got this amazing...
I mean, this is like a brilliant story.
Noel Coward doesn't have anything on this dressing gown, honestly. It was like the most garish, horrible kind of red silk thing with gold embroidery all over it. The girl who would subsequently become my girlfriend, she wheeled up to me in her wheelchair and went, No, she gave me her name. In the book, I call her Rebecca. She gave me her name and she kind of said, oh, I like your dress. You know? And I kind of looked at it and I was like, I could actually make less of an impact if I was wearing a dress. Because, you know, in my home environment, being myself was not a problem. Both my parents were incredibly liberal. I didn't tell my dad for a much longer time after I told my mum, which I feel guilty about, because all the assumptions I'd made about my dad's reaction, actually he was fine and he just loved me. And also, he knew as well. You know, he was like...
Probably knew before you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But to go back to what I was saying earlier, which is kind of the crux of where I was going with it, I came out to her. And then I had to almost immediately go back in because she was driving me back to school. Mm. So I then went back into hiding. And she said to me, Emmett, I'm so worried. She said, obviously, you've got no choice. You've got to express it. It's you. Yes. It's as much you as your disabled self. So you've got to express it. But I'm really worried that you're not going to find a partner, that you're not going to find the love that I'd like you to find. And from what I know, I'd grown up with several kind of honorary gay uncles who were friends of hers, who were lovely role models to be around, but they weren't disabled. Mm-hmm. You know, they weren't people I could follow in that way. And she just said, oh, from what I know from them of the gay community, I'm really worried because I don't necessarily think that you're going to be embraced.
Controversial to say, but I think I definitely have this feeling sometimes with Jasper that, because he's at a mainstream school and there aren't really any other kids with disabilities in school. And he has friends, but a lot of those friendships are fostered and encouraged by their parents. And there's a definite feeling of, you need to play with Jasper. And they're right. So kind to him and they embrace him and he loves to be with them. But I certainly have a small feeling of like gratitude for them for including Jasper. And I suppose I worry... let's say he was gay or straight, whatever, that there may be a feeling of pity or that somebody needs to take care of him or not just that pure, immediate love that I think you have with your husband, that's a true love that you find. As a parent, I worry, will he find that? Will that be the case? And I think if he were to turn around and say, I'm gay, it's like, how is this going to work out?
I mean, obviously, again, I can't speak for Jasper, and I hope that all your children are able to navigate the landscape. I mean, it's a long time since the period of time that I write about in the book, so hopefully, societally, we've moved on quite a lot. But and I hope that all your children are able to find really rich experiences and be able to integrate into the world in a slightly easier way than I thought that I could. But I have to be honest, I'm slightly pessimistic about that still. Because I think there's a great deal of stigma still and conscious and unconscious bias towards the disabled. I think there's an enormous amount of fear and not distaste, maybe that's too strong a word, but I think given the fact that the disabled community makes up so much of the population, you know, in terms of percentages, still not nearly visible enough, still not nearly accepted enough, still not represented enough. And actually, I think it was Scope, the disability charity, and I'm going to get my numbers wrong, I'm terrible with statistics.
We'll put them in the show notes anyway, you can fact check.
But they conducted a campaign called Let's End the Awkward, where they did a series of YouTube videos around, you know, ways in which the general public should and could approach the disabled and language that they, you know, basically things to do and not do. Yeah. And as part of that, I mean, I found it a bit difficult because it supposes that all disabled people are the same and that we're kind of monolithic. Mm. But for the purposes of a public conversation, you have to kind of be a bit more, you know, it's difficult because there are as many ways to be disabled as there are people in the world, right? You know, I'm as, you know, when I was...
I think you use the word disabled. Some people hate that word. Yeah. It's difficult to navigate.
Yeah, personally, I love the word disabled. I really find it empowering. I am disabled. I hate it when people say differently abled or special or... you know, just be, but that's me. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to be thought of in a very basic, not basic way, that sounds
black
awful.
And white.
Yes, yeah, just call me.
What I am.
Yeah. Well, first of all, call me Emmett, because that's my name.
Yes.
But if you have to refer to, maybe, who knows? But if you, I'd never want to write about myself ever again. not a novel next time, thanks. But I mean, again, I don't want to speak for anyone else, but I really appreciate the word disabled, and I know a lot of other activists do as well. I don't find it disempowering. It's just factual. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, language is difficult. Language is constantly evolving. But, yeah, I just find it just the most helpful way to describe what I am.
Yeah. A lot of the book talks about hiding and shame and kind of grappling with who you are. And, you know, we call this episode Owning Your Story. It feels like it took you a long time to get comfortable with your own identity.
A hugely long time, yeah, absolutely. I'd say it's still a work in progress.
So what's helped the most for you to feel comfortable in your own skin, to be comfortable with who you are and own those labels and your own
point.
Identity?
I think, to be honest, I had a real realisation. I write about this in the book. Very sadly, quite a number of the people at my school, and one of the boys who was actually one of the boys that bullied me, he was a hemophiliac, and he died of AIDS because he got an infected blood transfusion, or the clotting factor that was used. And I won't pretend that we were friends, we weren't, although we had a sort of rapprochement later in the book. But I went to his funeral. I wasn't going to go, but then I thought, you know, in a weird way, this boy has been a really huge part of your life. So you have to go and pay your respects to him, you have to go and honour him. So I went, and I remember coming back from the crematorium in the headmaster's car, and I just thought, it took a long time. It wasn't an instantaneous moment of acceptance. And as I say, I think it's still a work in progress some days. But I thought, your life might not look like what you want it to, but it's the only one you've got. Mm. And it's, you know, the title of my book, Go The Way Your Blood Beats. James Baldwin says, if you don't go the way your blood beats, you won't live some other life. You won't live any life at all. So the onus was on me then to make the most of my experience. And I really felt like, you know, however difficult my life is, I have the privilege of still being here, and actually I've got to grab it, I've got to embrace it, and actually, you know, I can't keep hiding, I can't keep apologising for myself, I can't keep being so uncomfortable, because I'm missing it, you know, and life is wonderful, life is really wonderful. And I know, you know, we spoke together before I came here today, and one of the things that struck me so much, and I've really thought about since, is how much, you know, your relationships have changed by being the mothers of disabled children, but how rich you find that and how important it is for all of you. And it's not the problem that society often likes to think. You know, disability is only thought of in terms of being a problematic thing or, in a worst-case scenario, a tragic outcome. And actually, you know, life can still be incredibly rich.
I think those exact emotions are exactly what I'm sure the three of us have gone through. Kind of, it's that grief process, but then it's like total acceptance. And like, this is great. It can be great. And
life's messy, right?
Yeah.
Life's fucking
so
messy. And it can be messy.
So messy.
So many points in your life.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. Because I think we could all do with a good dose of... I'm going to cry. I've just realised what a privilege it is, whether you
really,
have a disability or not. We all
really
have
is.
Flaws, we all have
it
shit.
It really is.
Everybody has, you know, challenges. And, it's a privilege to be here, isn't it?
It really
so,
is. It really is. And I was shaving this morning, ready to come here, and I noticed that more of my hair is going grey. And it's a lot thinner than it was, and it's probably departing in the next...
Well, that's a whole other grieving process.
Yeah, exactly. This is the departure lounge for my... for my Jewish hair. And I really feel all right about it, yeah. You know, because I'm here.
Yeah.
And I've written, going back to what you were saying about reclaiming your narrative and reframing, I've written my book, I have a husband, I have friends, I get asked to do lovely things like this, I have grey hair, I have a bit of a paunch, you know, like
don't we all?
But
it's well earned.
Yeah, exactly. But that's how far I've travelled, yeah. You know, and I used to not be able to look at my scars, and now I look at them in the shower, and I can't honestly say that they fill me with delight, but I have so much respect for how far I've come, and so much more compassion for my body and for myself. I mean, the language around disability has evolved, thank goodness. I was seen as a problem as a young child, and I absorbed that wholly, partially because of the surgical process and partially because of what was just in the society around me. I'm still regarded as a problem by some people, and I know that many people, you know, on a homophobic level, think that what I do and am is revolting. And that's one of the reasons why I was quite keen to get married. And I accept that other people, it's not a choice that they want to make, or it's not something that fits them. But I really wanted to get married because I'm very aware that in a lot of countries around the world, people who may want to get married can't.
Mm-hmm.
And people are living in fear of being discovered and, in some cases, you know, imprisoned or worse, but simply for being who they are. So the day when I got married to my husband was really, it was really profound for me in a way that I hadn't expected, to just be able to visibly say...
It's freedom, isn't it?
Yeah, freedom, exactly that.
Wake me up, loud as clouds, all my love for you.
So I suppose the question that I'd really like to ask the three of you is, did you think about disability as an identity in the disabled community before becoming parents and experiencing it? And what's your relationship like now to the notion of disability in your own children? I know it's kind of a big question. So,
it's a really good question. I think that disability hadn't crossed my mind at all. My older child is non-disabled, neurotypical, and she was under one, and we decided, hey, whilst we're in nappy mode, let's go again.
That's so good.
I know that not everybody, you know, can fall pregnant as easily, and all of my pregnancy I was just grappling with, oh, I'm gonna have two children, and I was feeling this like guilt for how am I gonna share my time between the two children, and I had this tiny little Olivia who was still a baby, and all I was thinking about was that. And I wasn't thinking about, quite frankly, I wasn't really thinking about who B was going
to
be.
I always think the decision to have a child is so selfish.
Oh,
it's all about us. And then as soon as they're 100%. Right, it's the most selfless thing you'll ever do. And that's the shock of it.
It completely changes. And I think growing up, I didn't see a lot of disability. It was not something that was really in my consciousness, if I'm honest. So it was a shock. My instincts or my reaction as a parent was, of course, I'm going to love this child, whoever they are. But it was just a whole shitload of unknowns of what their life would be, what the future would hold.
Mm-hmm.
Would they ever be able to do this or that? And, you know, it just feels a lot of that was about me and my picture of parenthood.
But that's legitimate too. I mean, that's one of the lovely things about the focus of this podcast is like it happens to the whole family.
Yeah.
You know, so your reality does change and it does affect your life.
100%. You know,
it's a collective experience. It really is. Anyway, sorry. I'm
No, it's so true. And I think I was in denial for a long time. I've talked about that on the podcast before. I'm very organized and I'm a planner and I like to know what's going to happen tomorrow, 12 months, 10 years time. I have like big plans. So this diagnosis that B got, and the fact I didn't know anything about 18q deletion or what that meant or what her childhood was going to look like and what her adulthood was going to look like really kind of messed with that plan. It took me a long time to realize that I didn't need to have a fucking plan. And as B got older, you know, just as a baby still, I think, and you get to know your child and their identity, you meet other people and other families and you see other children at hospitals and you realize this isn't fucking the end of the world. I have a beautiful little girl who's going to be who she's going to be. And she is not just disabled. She's cheeky. She's a flirt. She charms the pants off everybody she's around. I think when she was about 2, we were in a Carluccio's and somebody came up to us behind me and was like, I just want to say your kid's gorgeous. And so we said, oh, thank you very much. Started chatting to them. They walked away. I was with my father and he said, that guy really looked like Boy George. And I was like, Dad, it was Boy George. So, you know, whereas most people would go and like bother Boy George in a restaurant, he'd come over to talk to B because B had flirted and lured him in. Yeah, this is B. And
what
actually,
a lovely story.
Yeah, it was beautiful. I'm not going to pretend that I don't have moments of, I wish B's life was easier. I wish that she could communicate better with me, that I knew what was going on inside her head, that I could, I want to climb inside her head and figure out sometimes what she's really thinking or feeling. But God, I think Gemma referred to it earlier. I think I'm I think I'm a better person for having more of an understanding and I guess introduction and appreciation of disability in all of its forms. And it's amazing not caring about the fucking shit that some parents care about. The trivial crap.
Because in some ways, I can only speak for myself, but it does liberate. When I finally became a bit more confident and a bit more able to reject the ableist narrative that I've been, it kind of allows you a bit more freedom to write your own script.
Yeah.
Because if you think, well, if society is not going to accept me so readily anyway, what do those values matter? It allows you to question those values a lot
more. Fuck 'em.
Fuck 'em. Exactly.
So I think, you know, it's a very long-winded answer to your question, but I feel like
really interesting.
Yeah, I've become a better person. I've learned a lot about myself and I'm still fucking learning and trying to navigate this world with B. And figure out who she is and who she wants to be and how she wants to tell her story. And
I'm very similar to yours, to you. I had no concept of the disabled community. I wasn't exposed at all. I lived in a very... my parents were very much the perfect family and everything has to be perfect. So when Lua was born, like, she was a big black mark on our life and what we had imagined, or I had imagined, my parents had imagined, my partner, what our lives were going to look like. So for me, it was a big shock to the system and it was a full-on like grieving process. But I think having Lua has like brought me back down to earth. I think I was very like floaty and like, oh yes, and everything's great, da, da, da. And she's kind of shown me what life is actually like. Life can be shit, but that doesn't mean that it's shit. It just can be shit in that moment. And it's made me have so much appreciation for life. I think also because in the beginning, we just didn't know whether she'd survive or not. So I just appreciate life because it can be gone in an instant without
it really can.
No concept of what could happen in the future or none of that. And I think that's also why I just accept her fully for who she is. I have no preconceived notions or ideas of what I want her to be, which is how I went throughout my...
Which I imagine, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't want to... But that must be difficult to kind of jettison your vision of what life... What you were talking about just now, your vision of what life could and should be like when you're pregnant and, you know, I'm sure you kind of fantasize about what you're going to do.
Yep.
And then you have to kind of reconfigure all that and jettison some of it and embrace. So that must be really...
It was difficult. I think it was difficult until I got to the point where I accepted her. And I think because my partner, he accepted her immediately. Like the day she was born, we obviously knew that something was wrong. And he was like, okay, and like got on with it, while I was like, what the fuck is going on?
I find that quite moving, that you know, that there was just that instantaneous kind of, this is my daughter.
Yeah.
This is
there
my child.
There was no issues with what was going on. And I found that really difficult. But I think he just had no concept of like, and we were young, he was 28. I don't think he like really thought about it much, or like hadn't been exposed to children very much. He didn't have that. While I did, I had loads of cousins who had kids and I loved children. So I obviously had planned something in my head while he hadn't. He was like, yeah, I'm going to be a dad. Oh, she's born with a disability. Okay, we move. Let's go. Let's, you know, what can we do? So to
sounds
have
like
him.
Good people.
Yeah, he's great, I have to say. He is really great. But I think I struggled with the fact that he wasn't grieving like I was for the longest time.
That's interesting. So you both had very different experiences.
Totally different.
And so that, did that mean that you couldn't support each other at moments?
No. He was very, very patient with me. And he let me express my deep unhappiness for that first year. And I didn't bond with her because I was terrified she was going to die. So I was like, let me just not, for my own healing, let me not bond with her.
Self-protection, the
way until she got the all clear. After 7 months, we brought her home. And then I was like, okay, fine. And he kind of let me deal with that and was like, look, it's fine. He was so, so positive, which I found incredibly frustrating. Because sometimes you need someone to be in the ship with you and feel all the negatives. But,
or at least allow them.
Yeah. He was just like, no, this is how it's going to be. This is how she is. And we just have to like get on with it and give her as much support as she needs. And I think his positivity really like propped me up. Because I think when you're in a dark place, you only see that dark way. So to have somebody else's perspective in your ear going, actually, no, why don't you look at it like this? It could be like this. Yes, it's shit, but also... And it's that, but also, that really helped me to kind of look at it in a different way. And that's where I'm at now. And I think I don't care about her disability. I just don't give a shit about it. Like, it's part of her, but it's not her defining thing.
Yeah, it's an intrinsic part of who she is.
Yeah,
isn't it?
So it's like something I just don't see anymore, you know? And it's liberating. And I hope that she also doesn't... It doesn't affect her when she's... I think because she's so delayed in terms of, like, her cognitive understanding of what she is, you know? I don't think she sees... Lua is on this planet at the moment and she thinks everything is here for her. So she, like, lives through life as if, like, we're all pawns in her life. So I think it'll take...
She's such a diva. I love her.
Like, just she just thinks that we're all here for her entertainment.
And we kind of are,
yeah,
to be fair,
Rena. I mean, that's how I live my life. I am just here purely to please her. So, yeah.
Well, you have to please yourself too at moments. And...
I mean, pleasing her pleases me. So, you know.
That's handy.
Very, very. I mean, if she's not happy, she will really let us know. So, yep. I just love her. She's the thing that's made me, and I'm forever grateful to have her. Yeah.
That's really, it's lovely to hear. And I'm really struck by, similarly to my parents, what advocates you are for your children. That thing in the Andrew Solomon book about loving the children that you have rather than longed for reproductions of yourself. I love that idea that you have to take a moment to readjust, and then if you can, I'm not saying that everyone can, but love the person that you have.
Mm-hmm. I think we've spoken about this before, and that Jasper was just so ill when he was born for such a long period of time. We just felt like we were firefighting. Will he be alive tomorrow? Will he be alive later on? And I remember having this conversation with Ro in the very early days, like, just let him survive. He'll be, you know, whoever he is. He was a long-awaited baby. We'd gone through a lot of IVF. We just couldn't wait to meet this person. And then it was just hoping that he'll survive. And disability, you know, was the best possible outcome. In fact, if he walked in here, I've said this also before on the podcast today, you might not even notice his disability. That's how fortunate really he has been from where he started. when we were given his diagnosis, for example, I think they considered it would be a significant moment for us. You sit in the room and you're carefully given this diagnosis, but it just felt completely arbitrary because our baby's alive. He's this wonderful human being. It's completely irrelevant. And I think maybe it took us some time to start to realise that that part had finished, that he was alive and that he was flourishing and that he did have needs, extra needs that needed to be met. Obviously, we were meeting those needs, but that disability would form part of who he was. Everything he did was just like a win-win, a wow, amazing. And I remember meeting you, Lauren, for the first time. And I can't remember if we spoke about this before, so if I have, I apologise. But we were in a physio session and Bea and Jasper were just learning to walk, I think.
Yeah, they were bottom shuffling, weren't they?
They were sort of using the bars to shuffle along, and Lauren and I were kind of working each other
flirting,
out.
Friendship flirting.
I remember how I felt in that moment. I just felt so elated that there he was and he was doing, I didn't really even care what the outcome was. And I don't know if you were in a different headspace at that point. I don't know where you were at that time. I don't know if we've really spoken about
it. I think I was in a still, she's going to walk. If I have to get her physio like 3 times a week, she's going to walk. Yeah. And because that's going to be her story. Mm. And I don't feel good about having felt like that or thought like that. But that was my ableism.
But as we said, that was my ableism too. Mm. Of like walking to me was the
goal.
The thing, yeah, the absolute goal. Mm. And it was actually my mother who said, well, actually, you know, that's not necessarily the only way to have a fulfilling life. And it took me a very, very long time to catch up to that idea, to understand it fully.
Did your mum have friends who were disabled?
No. And
she's so enlightened.
Very similar to what you're saying. It wasn't a language that they knew. Mm. And it was the first time they had heard the word cerebral palsy or knew what it was when they were told that that was what I had. So. Mm.
On the subject of therapy, like, sorry to kind of rewind, but you talk a lot in the book, outside of the surgery, but about the physios and that original physio that drew smiley faces on your knees and things.
Pat.
Yeah.
Yeah,
how, looking back, how was that experience for you? I mean, I guess there were good therapists and bad therapists, but was it always kind of creating that additional ableist narrative that there was something wrong? Was it traumatizing for you, or was it fun?
I really, it's difficult because the physiotherapists that I interacted with, there were many that were very good, many that were very caring. And obviously I needed it, not in an ableist way, but just I needed it to help me move through the world. I did really resent it as I began to understand how long I would need it for, and it was time out of my day. It was, and also my friends didn't. I wasn't in special education at this point, so none of my friends had to do it. Mm-hmm. And it could sometimes feel quite punitive. It could sometimes feel quite punishing. And as you said, Lauren, it gives you the idea that you're somehow broken, or you need to be fixed, or that it, you know, worst case scenario, that it's your fault. And we talked about earlier about, you know, ableism having a moral dimension, and the idea that, yeah, somehow you've fallen short or you're bad, or, I mean, I think thankfully we've moved on as a culture, but it's difficult because the kindness that I received was huge, and the people's time that I received was massive, but at the same time I really resented having to do it.
The sort of ridiculous expectations that you put on life or on people in your life. Well, we talked about it, having a baby, you have all these expectations, and it's learning to let go of those expectations and see them for who they are and what they're going to be. What's much more important, and it's taken me a long time to realise, is nurturing her, who she is, and what and helping her to like assert who she is and be who she is, and enjoying that and having fun, and making childhood less about fucking therapy and achieving milestones, and much more about her mad sense of humour whenever she farts, blaming somebody else, and, you know, like
that. Also, as you're saying, that's much more to do with interrogating the medical model and the whole point of this podcast of what is normal. Let's interrogate what that looks like, and let's, you know, on a case-by-case, child-by-child, person-by-person basis, let's, and I love what you said, Rena, about, like, the way that it, kind of this pressure of perfection was kind of gradually released for you.
Mm-hmm. Massively. Yeah. It's so liberating when you just... And I think Lua's helped, because I think it's just her personality to take her sweet-ass time to do anything. So I went in with
Diva,
like...
Diva.
Yeah, she has to walk. And then it's like, yeah, I will walk when I'm four and when I decide one day to just walk. And I think I had pushed her and I had that whole concept of like, you're going to have to walk because I know that you can, kind of thing. And now, because she's shown us so many times that I will only do shit when I fucking want to do it. I don't give a fuck how much, like, therapies you take me to and how much you know, I will do it when I want. And Arbor and I have just let go.
You just got to go at their pace.
Yeah, that's it. Totally let go. And she surprised us last year when she started to feed orally. On a, like, it just happened with no input from us. Yeah, so now I'm like, I just have no expectations for you at all.
Take the gas. She'll be and do what she wants when she wants to do it.
How lovely of you all to share your stories with me. And it is really nice for me. I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to come on here today is to see the story from your experiences from the other side of the equation, if you like. And I really thank you for telling me your stories and sharing it with me and being such, you know, being such brilliant advocates for your children because you are, you know, and rather like my parents, you know, it's brilliant to have parents who, as Andrew Solomon says, rise to the challenge of having the children that they have and enjoying the challenge.
Oh, thank you.
Ditto on so much. Telling your story. Thank you. It's such been wonderful. And I absolutely love the book and encourage everybody listening to this podcast to go and buy it. Amen. You know, you don't need to sell it, Emma, because I'm going to sell it for you. It's out on the 6th of July.
6th of July, yeah, from Penguin Viking.
Right, okay. And it's called...
Go the Way Your Blood Beats.
Thank you. Go the Way Your Blood Beats. Beautiful story. But as we always do, we want to end on you telling us what your fucking normal is.
Right, he's not going to like this, but it's the truth. My fucking normal, although not normal fucking, for the homophobes out there, not normal fucking, is my husband. My lovely, lovely husband, who we got married last year, and it was very moving to me because I'm very mindful that in this world currently, lots of gay people don't have the opportunity or the right to get married, and so it felt quite important for me to do that. And I just, looking at him that day, I was delighted. I was absolutely delighted, and it was something that in my loneliest teenage moments, I never thought I would have access to. Just that, I was being interviewed the other day, and I said, apart from having written a book, my life is blissfully ordinary. You know, I'm in midlife, and I cherish the ordinariness of my life. You know, it's the kind of ordinariness that I never imagined I would have. So that's my fucking normal.
Beautiful.
Your fucking normal is blissful, ordinary.
Lovely. Blissfully ordinary.
Love that. Thank you so much, Emma. It's been so great to meet you properly.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to the Fucking Normal podcast. We love making this podcast.
Yes, we do.
We are part of a much bigger team, almost exclusively all parents of disabled children. And our goal is to reach as many people as possible and create a community of support for parents and carers who share our experiences.
So, if you've liked what you've heard, please like and subscribe so that we can reach out to more people.
You can find more information on this and other episodes at fuckingnormalpodcast.com. That's fkingnormalpodcast.com. You can join us on Facebook and on Instagram at fuckingnormal_podcast. That's fkingnormal_podcast. You can get all the links and more information in the show notes below.
So thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. We'll see you next time.
Bye.